Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the former head of Greece's Orthodox Church is laid to rest in Athens. A satellite television station brings information, entertainment and hope to Christians across the Middle East. But first, Pope Benedict meets with members of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith. Here in the Vatican, Pope Benedict met on Thursday with members of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, holding their plenary assembly this week, with a special focus on the new and complex challenges posed by bioethical developments. My colleague Chris Altieri takes a closer look.
Pope Benedict XVI said new technologies are not just the concern of doctors and specialists, but are also raising questions among people who learn of these developments through the media. Though the Church is not called to respond to every new scientific development, he said it's vital to remember the two basic principles that must guide all ethical considerations, namely respect for the human person from the moment of conception until natural death, and respect for the unique transmission of human life through sexual intercourse between husband and wife. In his address, Pope Benedict also recalled two important documents issued by the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith this past year. The first of those, responses to some questions regarding certain aspects of the doctrine on the Church, he said, reaffirms the teaching of the Second Vatican Council on the unity, indivisibility, and indestructibility of the Church of Christ, despite the divisions among Christians over the centuries. While declaring that the Church of Christ subsists in a unique way in the Catholic Church, Pope Benedict says this should be a stimulus rather than an impediment to authentic ecumenical commitment. The second document from the Congregation last December was a doctrinal note on some aspects of evangelization to counter what Pope Benedict called a persistent religious and cultural relativism. The recognition of goodness and truth in other religions, he stressed, cannot limit the missionary task of the Church to proclaim Christ as the way, the truth, and the life.
My thanks to Chris Altieri for that report. The former head of Greece's Orthodox Church, Archbishop Christodoulos, was buried in Athens on Thursday after 4 days of mourning across the nation. The ecumenical patriarch Bartholomew I, spiritual leader of the world's 250 million Orthodox faithful, presided at the funeral, which was also attended by a Vatican delegation led by Cardinal Paul Poupart and Bishop Brian Farrell, secretary of the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity. The Archbishop died on Monday at the age of 69 following a 7-month battle with cancer. His meeting with Pope Benedict in 2006 was seen as the start of a new era of cooperation between Catholics and the Greek Orthodox Church, following on from Pope John Paul's meeting with the Archbishop during his visit to Athens in 2001. That visit was strongly opposed by many members of the Greek Orthodox Synod, and in other aspects of his decade-long leadership too, the Archbishop was seen as a colourful and sometimes controversial figure.
I think among the public, he'd be remembered as someone who was constantly on the television, opposing government moves to liberalise society, opposing government moves to row back on the entrenched rights of the Greek Orthodox Church.
Felix Cawley is an expert on the Orthodox world and editor of Forum 18 news service reporting on religious rights and freedoms.
For example, he led a long campaign, including with street rallies, against removing the religion category on identity cards, which many religious minorities regard as a kind of a symbol of their second-class status and as an excuse for government officials to keep them down, to keep them in their place and to restrict their rights. So he'd be remembered really as a populist figure who knew how to tap into a certain mood among at least parts of the Greek population who longed for the glories of Hellenism, the glories of a coalition between the Orthodox Church and the state, the old symphonia of the Byzantine era, perhaps.
Let's look a little bit at his background then, how he came to hold these kinds of attitudes.
Well, that's quite interesting because he was born up in the north in Xanthi, very close to the borders with Bulgaria and Turkey. This is part of Greece that only became part of the Greek Republic after the First World War. There's a large Muslim population there. There's a lot of ethnic Bulgarians as well. And in Greece, there's very strong national identity around the nation, the language, and the church. And this is part of Greece which doesn't really fit in. And perhaps he came from this region where the long historical tensions with neighboring populations, the Turks especially, and also the Bulgarians, but part of his mental picture that Orthodoxy and Hellenism were embattled and had to be defended. So he had this in his bloodstream, so to speak. But interestingly, he also studied at a Catholic college in Athens. His parents brought him down to Athens, and his brother as well, when they were quite young. So he was exposed to other faiths as well through that, but yet that perhaps made him more entrenched in his view that Orthodoxy was the right path, that all other faiths were heretical or just plain wrong, and that the Greek church had preserved the purity of faith and in fact had purified the civilization of the ancient Greeks, the pagan civilization, and brought Christianity into it, and sort of refining both, so that all the glories of ancient pre-Christian Greek civilization were sort of melded together with Orthodox Christianity.
And yet, despite these strongly held views, he was also the man responsible for forging closer relations with the Catholic Church, wasn't he?
That's right. Well, from 1985, he was the ecumenical secretary, really, the head of the ecumenical department of the Greek church. So he had contacts with other faiths through that. But he's remembered really for defying a lot of the more rigid Greek Orthodox in 2001 when Pope John Paul II made the historic visit to Greece. Christodoulos was very pointed in saying he was welcoming him as head of state, as head of the Vatican, not as a religious leader with any kind of legitimacy. He also put great pressure on Pope John Paul II to apologize for all the terrible things that the Catholics had done against the Orthodox populations over many centuries. And Pope John Paul II, who obviously was very keen on the Catholic Church apologizing for many historic wrongs over the years, Pope John Paul II did issue an apology for the way that Catholics and Western Christians had behaved, especially during the Crusades. So I think that Christodoulos kind of straddled that one quite neatly. He could show local people who objected to his even meeting Pope John Paul II and welcoming him to Greece that he had gained some concessions out of him, while at the same time opening up ties to the Vatican. And Christodoulos did attend Pope John Paul II's funeral and did make a return visit to the Vatican to meet Pope Benedict in December 2006, which was a fairly cordial meeting. They signed a joint theological agreement and so on. So I mean, he was open to contacts with the Vatican.
Archbishop Christodoulos also had a rather controversial relationship with the ecumenical patriarch, didn't he?
That's right. I mean, the Orthodox churches have long had mutual suspicions and tensions over primacy, jurisdiction, and traditionally, many of the dioceses in northern Greece, the so-called new territories, under the direct control of the ecumenical patriarch, not the primate of the Greek church in Athens. And so there was tension there, and in even 2003, there were several months when there was a break in relations, and during the liturgy, the mutual recognition of each other was suspended, which is very embarrassing, really, for both sides. I think Bartholomew was very unhappy with the actions that Christodoulos, the conflict that Christodoulos triggered and the challenging to his authority. But this was eventually smoothed over because both of them have to live with each other. And the position of the ecumenical patriarch Bartholomew in Istanbul is fairly precarious. And I don't think ultimately the Greek church would want to make life any more difficult for Bartholomew. But also something that annoyed other people was the meddling that Christodoulos engaged in other patriarchates, which have traditionally been very Greek-dominated, especially the Jerusalem patriarchate, where he really engineered the election of Irenaeus as Patriarch of Jerusalem, only for Irenaeus to be unseated rather unceremoniously a couple of years later over allegations that he'd been selling church-owned land to Israelis and this type of thing, engaging in very dodgy business practices.
Who do you think that the synod is likely to look to for the next leader in Athens?
Well, it's completely unknown. I think the Christodoulos obviously was named because he was close to the previous incumbent, Archbishop Seraphim. He was right at the heart of the church. People saw him as someone who could bring modernization, bring a public visibility to the church, sort out many of the problems, put it on a proper footing. He established websites, radio stations, a lot of charitable activity, helping trafficked women, for example, single mothers, a very practical sort of things. And he also set up the first Greek church charity to conduct overseas aid. He set up an office for the European Union. So, I mean, he did all the organizational work to bring the church into the modern world, to help it to tackle today's problems. But his very public persona was so dominant that it's difficult to see who else will step into his shoes, whether they'll go for someone completely different or someone in the same mold.
And my thanks there to Felix Corley, editor of Forum 18 News Service. A message of hope for Christians across the Middle East and North Africa. That's what the Christian satellite television Sat7 tries to bring to those minority communities that are often harassed, discriminated against, or in parts of Iraq today targeted in a ruthless campaign of killing and persecution. Sat7 first began producing a few hours of programming a week in Arabic over a decade ago, realizing the enormous potential of satellite television to reach Christians in countries where publications are censored or banned for fear of proselytism and conversions among the mainly Muslim population.
It's not just a fear of proselytism, it's actually a total intolerance of any Christian presence. If you look at Saudi Arabia, the supposed cornerstone of American foreign policy today, there's still no places of worship for non-Muslims in that country.
Terry Ascott worked on Christian publications in Egypt before founding and becoming chief executive officer of Sat7. The station now runs a 24-hour Arabic channel, as well as a channel for programs in Farsi and Turkish, and another dedicated exclusively to children and young people in the many different countries across the region.
There are tens of thousands of Christians living in Saudi as expatriate workers, with no official place of worship. So the idea of actually having any kind of voice in society, in that kind of society, has been impossible. Now, satellite television initially was opposed by Arab governments. So Saudi Arabia banned dishes, so did a few other countries. Iraq banned dishes right up until the war. But it didn't stop the importation and installation of dishes. In Saudi Arabia, when they eventually legalized dishes in, I think it was 2002, already 75% of homes in the kingdom had got at least one dish. So it wasn't ever enforced. So rather than try to ban dishes, Arab governments set out to compete with each other for hearts and minds. And so there was a massive investment in the 90s and on into this century in satellite television services, especially by the Saudis, who've got a number of very attractive commercial channels with films and so on, music.
And so you're broadcasting right through the Middle East and North Africa in several different languages, aren't you, besides Arabic, also in Farsi,
yeah,
Turkish?
Yeah, we started in Arabic, and then we had requests for help for the churches in Iran and also Turkey. So we began a Farsi service in 2002 and a Turkish service in 2006. But of course, we were including this in the schedule of the Arabic, and so we would lose all our Arab viewers every time we changed language, and that wasn't very strategic. So a year ago, we put the Farsi and Turkish off onto another frequency, another channel, and have today got these two different Arabic-only channel and the other one just for non-Arabic languages. And then we had another scheduling problem, and that was for children, because we've had tremendous response from kids right across the Arab world, from Morocco through to Bahrain. And whole families, even though they're not from a Christian background, would gather round and take part in these children's programs, send in competition entries and so on. And it really seemed like an open door. But the problem was, when do you schedule for children when you're covering five time zones? We would have programs that were suitable for children in Egypt in the late afternoon, but then the kids in Morocco were still in school and the kids in Bahrain had gone to bed. So the idea came of having another channel just for children's programming, and after quite a bit of effort, we managed to get that third channel on air just before Christmas, this past Christmas.
So it's a really expanding project. How many people have you got working in the different places where you're putting these programs together?
Well, we've got studios in Cairo, we've got studios in Lebanon. Between them, they've got about 100 staff. And then, of course, we outsource a lot of production work. And we're hoping to open studios in Jordan to service, actually, Iraq, because there's a lot of need and opportunity in Iraq. And certainly satellite television provides the Christians in Iraq with a very important lifeline. They cannot go out at night. There's dangers, there's social isolation, there's discrimination and persecution, and many of them are locked up at night in their homes, and Sat7 does provide a vital link and words of encouragement, teaching that they would perhaps have gotten if they were able to move around freely and go to church, but they don't and they cannot.
So what kind of programming are you mainly focusing on these different channels? You say quite a variety, a mixture of inspirational and informative, but how do you start putting together this kind of program schedule for such a wide audience?
Well, when we began, we were very deliberate. We didn't want it to be like the typical Western Christian television channel that sold half-hour blocks of teaching program to sponsors. And we set out to be holistic. You know, we want to cover everything from advanced theological teaching right through to health, hygiene, safety, environmental issues, vocational guidance. So it was going to be holistic. But more to have different genres of programming, film, cartoons for kids, music, Arab drama, straightforward teaching, discussion programs, current affairs, live. So it is a very varied mix that you would find on a typical national broadcast television service, with special blocks for children twice a day, women twice a day, youth, and then general blocks and a teaching zone too later in the evening.
So, as you say, a very wide variety. What kind of listenership do you think you have?
Well, we have been able to measure it in 8 Arab countries through secular marketing companies, and the current estimate of our weekly viewership, that is someone who would watch at least once a week, perhaps every day, perhaps once a week, is between 7 and 8 million people, which is really very encouraging. It's a small percentage of 300 million from the Arab world, but it's still a very significant number of people for a television service.
It's also true that Christians in many of these countries are fleeing. We think of Iraq particularly, of course, but other places from Israel, from Lebanon. Many of these countries, Christians are a fast diminishing minority of the population. How much of this is of a concern to you?
Absolutely. In fact, some of our board members, especially the Lebanese, Monsignor Abu Jaudi, for example, this is one of their main concerns. If you look at Lebanon, that was before independence in the mid-40s, at least 55% Christian. Today, it's probably less than 30% are Christian in name. If you look at Palestine, in the last 100 years, the Christian population's gone from 20% down to less than 3% in some areas. I mean, Gaza, out of several million people, there are perhaps 2,000 Christians left. And Iraq, the Christian population's been totally decimated, and those that haven't left the country have been internally displaced. So it is a tragic situation. And it is one we're seeking to address by providing encouragement and support as much as we can for that Christian minority. And also at the same time addressing in society the general things that are driving them out. And one of these is to do with the very common non-inclusiveness that exists in the Arab world. There's the House of Islam and there's the House of War. You're either a Muslim or you are somehow a second-class citizen. And even though the constitution of your country may guarantee you equal citizenship rights, in the final analysis you're treated like a protected minority. You are not allowed to take positions of authority over Muslims. very often your ambitions are stifled at school or the university. You certainly don't get on in the civil sector, and even in public hiring of private companies, there is discrimination against Christians. So many of the brightest and the best tend to emigrate. There are now, for example, over 1 million Coptic Orthodox Christians living in the USA today. And these are the doctors and the engineers that could have been strengthening and building up the church in Egypt. So there's a horrible brain drain of Christians from the region. And teachers and pastors are among them. So to try and get some of these back, at least through television services, is one of our goals.
This message that you're putting forward, that these people, these Christians, do have equal rights, is not one that sits comfortably, as you say, with many governments, business leaders, perhaps. Do you think of yourselves as in any way at risk because of this message that you're trying to put through?
Yeah, even if we weren't, just to broadcast anything about Christianity in Arabic is a risk. In fact, you know, the first phone call we ever had, just an hour, the first hour we started broadcasting was, Mishmaul, this is impossible. Am I seeing Arabs speaking about Christianity on television, wearing a cross on the television? It was like an oxymoron. To be Arab means to be Muslim. And yet there are something like 17 million indigenous Arab Christians, but they're very invisible within the Arab context and to the Western world.
You're broadcasting a message of encouragement and support. Of course, what many of these people really need to stop them fleeing or leaving for a better life abroad is economic security. Security, first of all, in situations like Iraq, maybe in Lebanon today, but also economic security. Can you address in any way these kind of issues?
We can through various programs. One of them has been where we've profiled small micro-enterprise projects that anybody with a little bit of initiative can take, and minimal capital, minimal training. And so we try to encourage people to, even if they cannot find a job, at least they can create for themselves a small company or to provide services or goods in the local society. But that is a small, you know, it's a small contribution to the whole dialogue. And of course, it's not just Christians that are suffering from this lack of hope and lack of opportunity. It's many, the whole community, really, in many areas. And as you rightly say, it stems from security. But I think one of the key things that people do need is hope and some kind of optimism about the future, but also the hope that Christ can give in a situation. If one can see that God is in control and you can have hope about your life and that God is good, and so on. This does bring a sort of optimism that is very healthy for the church.
You call yourself a Christian station. What about the denominational differences? We have this image of the different denominations fighting over the Holy Sepulchre and who owns which bit.
Horrors.
And
yeah.
How ecumenical relations don't always work well there in the Arab-speaking world, do they?
No, they don't, unfortunately. But actually, it's been very exciting to see people gather around this project. We've had some very clear goals and parameters and program policy and basis on which we work together, including the program policy, basic doctrinal creeds, and a commitment not to be critical of other denominations or religions. I think faced with all the challenges that the Christian church has in the Middle East, it's not hard for them to put aside the small differences that exist and come together and to propagate the huge common beliefs, interests and concerns that we have. We have a sort of little slogan inside the station, and that is to show the unity of the church and yet the diversity of belief and practice within the Christian community. So we're not trying to deny that, but we certainly want to highlight the unity that does exist in our Christian faiths.
In these mainly Muslim countries, we talk about the dialogue of life, and you're a part of that, aren't you, with this broadcasting. But what about actual dialogue with the Muslim majority there? Are you able to do that in any way through this station?
We are, especially on non-theological issues. And we can have Muslims in for discussion on ethical issues, euthanasia, abortion, genetic engineering and so on. And there is some common ground. But we are not trying to find a theological compromise or common ground, really. We have to admit that we have differences. Interestingly, many of our viewers, of course, are from a Muslim background, and they are sincere, God-seeking Muslims. And they're very attracted by Christian teaching about the love of God, about the grace of God, about what it really means to serve God. And rather than being polemic, actually, our programming is speaking, I think, especially to sincere Muslims, because they have struggled to know God in a personal way. The God of Islam is not a personal God. He's very remote, very severe, especially for women. I was listening to a lady who'd been a Muslim before, and she really actually began to hate God because of the status of women in Islam and the way women were treated, and especially when she looked at the afterlife and the role of women. And that was the thing that really pushed her to become a Christian in the end. We try to be as constructive and positive as we can, and to offer or to make available information about the Christian faith so that people can make an informed choice for themselves. But we certainly don't want to be manipulative or accused of coercion or seeking to proselytize. But we, as Christians, do believe it is our not only right and our duty to proclaim the Christian faith so that people may be informed and make their own personal choices.
How then can Christians elsewhere in the world support this mission, support the work that you're doing there in the Middle East?
Well, obviously, television broadcasting is expensive just for satellite time and the production of programs. So financial help is obviously needed. To pray for our staff, pray for protection. You mentioned the dangers. We have had incidents in the past, including the burning of a studio in one of our locations. And we live with a fairly high level of insecurity, especially Lebanon in these days is a very strange, bizarre kind of situation, and nobody is secure. We are just a 10-minute drive away from Hezbollah headquarters, and our studios are quite vulnerable to anything that they may disagree with. So pray for security, pray for inspiration and encouragement, because people cannot make programs if they themselves are depressed by a local economic or political situation. Pray for the churches, that the leadership may know how to encourage and to build the flock, because these are terribly difficult days, especially for the church leaders in Iraq of all the different denominations, and in Lebanon and Egypt. I mean, I could just go on, really, actually, but certainly there are challenges. I think one of the bright spots has been Iran. We've had an amazing response from Iran to the broadcasts. Iran actually does defy all the stereotypes. I mean, we look at it as being very anti-Christian, anti-Western, anti-American. But I think what sums up the contradiction is when I was in Tehran, there was this wall poster, you know, there's an American flag in flames and bombs coming down and the slogan, Death to America. And walking right in front of it was this young lad in a T-shirt, and on it was, I love New York. And it's that kind of contradiction. Yes, there are a few fanatics, and it's a government line to be anti-Western. But interestingly, the most pro-American population in the Middle East today are the Iranians. Anything that comes out of America is good for the middle class. And we've had a tremendous interest in the broadcast from Iran, with many people responding. So continue to pray that God would work in hearts and lives, that he would encourage those Christians that have remained in these somewhat difficult circumstances. And there are some wonderful brothers and sisters living in Tehran today, in all the different churches, and they need our support, our love, our prayers.
And my thanks there to Terry Ascott, founder and chief executive officer of the Christian satellite television station Sat7. And for more about their work, you can find them on the internet at www.sat7.org. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.